Okay, good morning, everybody. I hope you can all hear me. I will just say, like I normally say in advance, that if there is a glitch in the Wi-Fi, then I just have to beg your forbearance, and we usually clears after a couple of minutes. We have David Hochhauser here from the OU on site with his headphones on, ready to pounce if there's any problem. And therefore, hopefully we won't have a problem and we'll be able to go forward, but please bear with us if we do a little bit. A few introductory remarks, and then we'll move into our share. First of all, Mrs. Spivak, Hannah Spivak, is here on the share. She is in charge of sponsorships for the share, and I would encourage anybody who is interested in sponsoring the share to please be in touch with Mrs. Spivak. She's very happy to hear from you. We'll be very happy to receive your sponsorship of all different types, so please be in touch with her. Definitely would encourage that. And that leads me into today's sponsorship, a very special sponsorship today. Mrs. Rachel Steiner is on the screen here. We can see her, and we're very grateful that she's joined us. She has sponsored the share today in loving memory of her husband, our love of Shalom, Professor Mark Steiner. Mrs. Steiner and Professor Steiner have been regulars at the shir. As she mentioned, this was one of the shirim that they both came to together, and certainly seeing them both at the shir has been an incredible chizuk for me over the years. Obviously, we're delighted that Mrs. Steiner is going to continue to be hopefully with us at the shir, and we're very sorry that Professor Steiner is not going to be able to be with us at the shir, because obviously Professor Steiner passed away very tragically a couple of weeks ago in this really terrible tkufa that so many people have suffered so much loss. And therefore, the shir is sponsored in his memory, Le'ilu Nishmas Mordechai Yehuda Ben Ephraim, Zecher Livracha, Zichron Livracha, and we should learn Le'ilu Nishmato Be'ezrat Hashem. Professor Steiner was a very, very special individual, and I mentioned before in this forum that it was a big covert for me anyway, that he was there at the shir, he commented, he often send me emails, very interesting emails, picking me up on things that I did wrong, helping me understand better things that I didn't understand as well, and sometimes just giving me wonderful stories that I have been able to use in subsequent shiurim. Professor Steiner had a wonderful sense of humor. And what I've done is I posted on the group chat, as well as the sheet for today's shiur, I posted a copy of the obituary that Rav Yitzchak Adlerstein wrote for Professor Steiner on Cross Currents, which is well worth downloading and having a read through. He really was a very unique individual that combined the very highest level of secular achievement as a very eminent philosopher of mathematics, together with an enormous love for Torah. He was a Talmid Chacham, had an enormous depth and breadth of Torah, really phenomenally so. And he understood Chazal as well as the philosophy, because he was such an eminent philosopher, he understood the depths of the philosophy of Torah and Chazal, and therefore that combination is extremely rare, and certainly was wonderful for me, insofar as I did get to know him, and we're terribly grateful to Mrs. Steiner for sponsoring this year. Thank you very much, and we certainly hope that the learning we do today will be Ilu Nishmato. He is very much missed. The topic, I suspect he would have actually very much enjoyed, is a topic which is quite controversial, which we started last week, which is the issue of women, specifically religious women, serving in the IDF. And let me recap with you what we did last week, and then we can move forward to this week's share, which I think is going to take us into certain realms which we've not really looked at before. One in particular, a very important halachic issue of cross-dressing. We'll see what that got to do with the Israeli army. And then the more amorphous issue of tzniut. Tzniut is always a topic that everybody loves, or loves to hate, or hates to love, or whatever it is. It's a topic. It's difficult, it's controversial, it's complex. But it goes to one of the issues we need to talk about today in the hashkafic realm as well. So let's just recap what we did last week, and then we can move into this week's material. It's clear from Tanakh that women did not serve in the Jewish army. That's clear. Now, whether that's relevant or not is a different question, because we don't normally learn halacha and hashkafa directly out of Tanakh. It's learned through the prism of Chazal. But it's very clear that the Jewish army was a male army. We brought lots of precedents for that last week, with a few exceptions. Dvora, Yael, we'll talk more about Yael today. However, the Mishnah in Sota, we saw last week, says very clearly that in a milchemet mitzvah, a war which is a requirement, a mitzvah for the Jewish people to fight, which we defined as any war which is protective of the yishuv in Eretz Yisrael will be a milchemet mitzvah. We defined that quite carefully last week. In a milchemet mitzvah, says the Mishnah, everybody goes to war. Even the chatan michedro, the kala michupata. Even the kala from under her chuppah. And this is therefore a very major source from which many poskim learn that in principle women have to go to fight in a milchemet mitzvah. We saw last time that the Radvaz, which we'll see again this time, qualifies that, waters it down, says no, doesn't it say elsewhere in Chazal, it's not the derech of women to fight. They shouldn't be in the front lines, and therefore what could that mean that the Chala comes to the war? It could mean that she supports the war effort, logistics, supplying food, supplying technology, whatever it is, today's logistics support, that could be what's going on. We'll see more of that soon. But the poskim of today's world, almost across the board, notwithstanding the source in Sota which seems to say women go to war, the poskim are almost all against the idea of religious women fighting the IDF. Both in combat units, that's for sure, and even in many cases in other roles as well. And those poskim go across the Hashkafic spectrum. Needless to say, from the Haredi world, there's really nothing to talk about. They're against women going to Shirut Lumi as well. But even within the religious Zionist world, we saw that there is a broad consensus, even towards the left of the religious Zionist world, Rav Yuval Shurlo, Rav Yehuda Henkin, who is very sensitized to women's issues, and including women, is against women fighting in the IDF. There are some voices in favor, Rav Benny Lau, Rav Shlomo Riskin, these are voices in support in many ways, but we're going to look a little bit more at why that is today, and really speculate a little bit on the philosophical issues. The reality is that around 2,500 religious Dati girls join up every year to the army. Someone just said, please post the sources. So I did already, but I will again. The thing is, if you come in after the sources are posted, then you don't catch something on the group chat. But it's okay, because I've just posted them again. So anyone who came in after those sources went up should now have them. They should appear on the computer as well. Hopefully, they should have gone up now. Despite the pretty much broad consensus that women should not be in the IDF by most poskim, 2,500 religious women join up a year. That's a significant number. It's around 35% of the Dati graduates from the Ulpanot, the high schools. They do that against the advice of their Rabbanim, against the advice usually of their teachers in Ulpana. But they serve, and they serve in many cases with distinction in the army. And therefore, what's driving that disconnect? We'll talk about a little bit about that in a minute, because that's a very important factor as well. So today what I want to look at is a couple of halachic issues, but really look at the hashkafa issues here as well, because I think that's what we're trying to get to terms. Okay, fine. I'm going to share the screen. Let's first look at the issue of cross-dressing. Now, what's cross-dressing got to do with anything to do with the IDF? As far as I'm aware, in the IDF, the men dress like men and the women dress like women. So why are we even talking about this particular issue? Have a look with me on the sheet, please. Let's start with the Pasuk in Dvarim. Lo yikle gev al isha. A woman may not wear man's clothing. We'll define this much more carefully. Lo yilbash gev simlat isha, and a man may not wear a woman's dress. Okay. Ki ta'avat Hashem Elokecha kol oseh eileh. Because this is a ta'iva. A ta'iva is a very strong word. It's hard to define the word ta'iva. I dislike the translation that's usually used, which is abomination. Abomination is a word which I, in my mind, I hear through the voice of actually the Northern Irish voice of Ian Paisley or someone like that, who says it's a very Christian kind of word. Abomination, it's hard. And also we don't use the word abomination in society, in general use. I mean, we talk about the abominable snowman, but I don't think that's the same thing at all. But Tu'eva is bad. Tu'eva is a very bad thing. And therefore, we have to work out why is this issue of cross-dressing called a to'eva? Is it that bad? We'll see the Gemara in a minute. Interestingly, the Targum Unklus in number 2 talks about this directly and translates this pasuk, lo yehei tikun zayin degeva al ita. immediately on the spot says, what does it mean cross-dressing? A woman may not carry weaponry. A woman may not carry a sword. And then it says, v'lo yitkan geva b'tikunei ita, and a man may not do effeminate things, more about that in a minute, because it says, arei merchak kodem Hashem. This distances us from Hashem. So you see right at the very outset, the Targum Onkelos, which, let's not forget, the Beis Yosef and others bring down, the Targum Onkelos was written by Ruach HaKodesh. With Ruach HaKodesh, it's a very ancient source, very, very special source, goes back 2,000 years. It immediately equates the issue of women, of cross-dressing with women not being allowed to carry weapons. Let's have a look at this. Number three. Says the Gemara, Lo yehe kli geva al isha. My Talmud Loma, what is the Gemara telling us? And we're going to see a very important machlokas in the Gemara here. If you're simply telling me that a man may not wear women's clothing, the isha simlat isha, and a woman may not wear man's clothing, but it says to'eva. To'eva hi. Ain't time to'eva. That's not a to'eva. To'eva is usually associated with a very explicit negative sexual prohibition. Other things as well, by the way. Not eating insects is a to'eva. Not cheating in business is a to'eva. So there's a lot to say about that. But cross-dressing, says the Gemara, doesn't sound like a to'eva. Ella says the first view, the Tanakhama here, Shalom Yilbash Ish Simlat Isha, a man shouldn't wear women's clothing. Why? The Yeshev Bein Hanashim, so that he can mix with women. It's all about mixing with women. The Isha Simlat Ish, and a woman should not dress up as a man. The Teshev Bein Gvarim Bein Hanashim, so she can mix with men. Meaning, there's an agenda. And this is very important. According to this first view in the Gemara, it's not the cross-dressing per se that's the problem. It's the agenda. It's going to lead to some kind of very inappropriate mixed environment, which is going to have some kind of sexual negativity to it. That's the view of the Tanakhama. Rabbi Eliezer says, no. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says, Minan shall I take to Isha b'klei zayin? How do I know the woman may not wear a sword? L'milchama, for war. He includes the word war there, which is interesting. Targum Onkelos didn't say that word. Talmud Loman, he brings the Pasuk. Lo yeh kli geva al isha, and how do I know a man may not dress like a woman or act like a woman? Lo yeh bash geva tinat ish, shelo yeh tani ish b'tikuna isha. What you have here is a machloket between two opinions, one of which says that there is an objective prohibition on wearing a sword, let's say, a weapon for a woman, and the other of which says there is a prohibition only if there is an agenda, only if it's going to lead to something which is more sexually loose in that sense. And we're going to have to look at the postgame and see whether a woman carrying a weapon in the IDF is objectively prohibited. That's it. There's nothing to talk about. A woman may not carry a weapon. Or whether we're going to say no. The context of why the women are carrying weapons is obviously not one which is trying to merge the sexes in some way. We'll have to see how the postgame come up with that. And of course, Pikuach Nefesh. We will talk about that as well. Fine. Rashi equates the view of Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov with Onkelos. Sorry, that went wrong there. One second. I meant to be sharing my screen. Let me just share my screen. Okay, that should be working. Rashi number four equates those two opinions. I'm not getting into that so much more now. But the Rambam Lahalocha says something very interesting. Number five. Loi ta'adi isha adi ha'ish. Lo ta'adeh isha adi ha'ish. A woman may not wear men's clothing. Kagoin, and he gives an example here. She tassim barosha mitznefet. She may not put a helmet on, okay, or a turban, a man's turban, or kava, or tilbash shiryon. She may not wear shiryon. Now, what's shiryon? Shiryon, of course, is the word in Hebrew now for the tank regiment. It's the armored corps. She may not put on armor, or kiyotibo, or things like that. She may not shave her head like a man. This is all brought down in halacha. And a man may not dress like a woman. And then he said, the hakol kaminag medina. And this is one of the reasons why this whole issue is going to become much more amorphous, but very interesting, is it depends on the minhag, says the Rambam. You can't define, way back in the times of Chazal, or even earlier in the times of the Torah, you can't define forevermore what is considered masculine and feminine. It's going to depend, and we're going to see examples of this. May a man look in a mirror? This is one of the classic examples brought down in the postgame of something which is considered prohibited because it goes against the mitzvah of cross-dressing. So can a man look in a mirror today? So men look in a mirror all the time today. In the bathrooms, in religious institutions, in the men's bathrooms, there are mirrors. So what changed? We'll see what changes the Minhag Hamadina changed. Okay, so who is the Rambam passing like? I don't want to get too bogged down in the halacha here, but the Rambam, there's a machlokas. Who's the Rambam going like? The Kesef Mishnah says the Rambam is clearly going like Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov. So there's an objective prohibition on women carrying weaponry, irrespective of the agenda. And yet the Haggadah Maimonides says no, the Rambam is passing like the first opinion, that all depends on the agenda. So that's very important, because that will determine how we paskin in the end for women carrying weapons. Is it just objectively prohibited, or is it prohibited because of the context and the fact that it's going to lead to mixing in this way? Let's just take an excursion for a second and look at Ya'el. Rashi, on the spot, in this Gemara, says a very interesting thing. Number 8. Lo yeh klegeva al isha. V'zeh shem asinu b'Ya'el. This is what we find with Ya'el. Eshet Cheva Hakeni, the wife of Cheva Hakeni, in Sefer Shoftim. Shalah harakta leSisera. Okay? She didn't kill Sisera, the clay zion, with a sword. What did she use? She used a tent peg. Why did she use a tent peg? Says Rashi, She put her hand on a tent peg. And he gets this from, Rashi's getting this from the Targum Yonason. The Targum Yonason on the story of Ya'el makes this point very specifically. And he says, looking number 9 for a second, the Targum Yonason says, Tavta Ya'el is the Chedesh Shalma'a. What a good thing Ya'el did. Why? The climate mad because the safe right of the Moshe, because she was very particular. She was makpid to keep the mitzvah of the Torah. Lo yehe tikun zayin the gather al itata, that a woman may not carry a man's weapon. Okay, and therefore she picked a tent peg in order to kill Sisera. It's interesting. What else could she have used? Well, I assume that Sisera's sword, based on the context here, Sisera's sword was presumably lying there. Remember the story of Judith and Holofernes. That's in the book of Judith, where Judith kills Holofernes. What does she use to kill Holofernes? She uses Holofernes' sword and chops off his head. Okay? Remember David and Goliath. David also uses the sword of Goliath to chop off Goliath's head. So why didn't Ya'el use Sisera's sword? So you could argue, look, maybe he didn't have a sword because he was running away, but it sounds very much from the context of the Midrash here that she chose specifically to not use the sword in order to fulfill this mitzvah of a woman not carrying the weapon of a man, which is, there's a lot made of that midrashically. By the way, just in parentheses, the midrash, the Targum Yonason, translates the mitzvah of cross-dressing as not using, a woman not using a sword. The Targum Yonason on Chumash translates it otherwise. The Targum Yonason on Chumash says the mitzvah of cross-dressing is a woman not wearing tzitzit and tefillin. Now, leaving that aside, whether a woman is allowed to wear tzitzit and tefillin under any circumstances, because it seems that we do not paskin like that particular opinion. Someone just said maybe the sword was too heavy. I don't know. I've got a daughter called Ya'el. It's a very strong name. I'm sure she'd have needed to pick up the sword. She'd have picked up the sword. But I don't know. That I can't tell you. If David could have picked up Goliath, I don't know. Whatever. But the Targum Yonason on Chumash translates this mitzvah as a woman not wearing tzitzit and tefillin. The Ravaz, and I brought you a footnote, if you're interested in the footnote, if you have the sheet, the Ravaz says this is a proof that the Targum Yonason on Chumash is not really the Targum Yonason. It's a very interesting, almost academic topic, but it's actually discussed by the Mephorshim. Who was Yonatan? Yonatan ben Uziel. Yonatan ben Uziel, who was the Talmud, the star Talmud of Hillel, Hazakim. So the Gemara in Megillah says Yonatan ben Uziel wrote the Targum on Nach, on Tanakh. Whereas it seems that Yonatan ben Uziel on Chumash, it was not really Yonatan ben Uziel. That's why if you read any academic books, you'll see the Targum Yonatan on Chumash is always called Targum Pseudo-Yonatan. Because it's not really Yonatan. It's actually the Targum Yerushalmi. And as I just mentioned, that the Radbaz uses this example where they translate it two different ways in two different places as a proof that it's not the same person. Which I thought was very interesting. If you'd have just talked about this, people would have said, oh, that sounds too academic. Lo nachon, it's in the Radbaz, it's in the classic Mephorshim. But let's get back to the point here. The point being, why is this context of a woman carrying a weapon so viewed so negatively? So let me bring you two sources before we get into a closer definition. Rabbeinu Bachya says here, and it's going to get a little bit controversial, so just bear with me a little bit. Rabbeinu Bakhi says the following: Mana akasav klei zayim min ha'isha. Why does the verse, why does the Torah so much want to avoid women carrying weapons? Kidei sheloi teitin milchama v'yeisiba leznut. Because when women go to the front lines, says Rabbeinu Bakhi, that is znut. You're going to have a lot of loose sexual immorality between the men and the women. More about that soon. V'chein ha'ish, and so too, if a man is going to dress up like a woman, it's going to lead to znut. The Chizkuni goes even further. Look in the Chizkuni number 11. Lo yeh kligeva la'isha, l'feishahu genayu pritzus. This is a breach of tzniut. Pritzut means this is terribly inappropriate. U'lekach loy nitla ya'el cherev, or chanit. That's why Ya'el didn't take a sword or a spear. Ela makavet liyatet. She took a hammer and a tent peg. L'machat rakat Yisra, in order to rakat Yisra to go through his head. The Nismucha Pasha Zukan Lafisha Dibel Amala B'inyani Milchama. And doesn't the Pasha above, which we'll see soon, talk about actions in war? And here's the controversial statement. Please sit tight for a second. The Ha'ish, the Isha, Loi Nivrek Rak Lahakim Zera. And women were only created to have babies. Women were created to make families, not to fight wars, says the Chizkuni. Then Taitel Milchama, and if she goes out to war, Targil et atzma li deiz nut, she'll become much more accustomed to sexual looseness. V'chein imil bashgeva simlat isha, so too if a man wears a woman's clothing. Very interesting. Now, obviously, you can see from that immediately that that kind of a statement, if your rabbi stood up in shul and said, well, let's face it, folks, women were really only created in order to have babies and families, that's going to be the end of his rabbinic tenure, probably in many places. But why? The question is, well, isn't this a source? The answer is, we'll see. Obviously, this is something which is a moving target, something which changes. Let's talk about that just for a second within the halacha. How do we define what is considered masculine or feminine? So as we mentioned in the Rambam before, clearly it's all according to the Minhag HaMedina. For example, for a man today, is it prohibited for a man to have a manicure? I don't think it's called a manicure because they're the man. It's called a manicure because it's on your hands, obviously. Is it okay for a man to have a manicure? Okay. What about a pedicure? Is that considered to be... No, that's just effeminate. The answer, people might say, well, no, many yeshivish guys today have manicures. One of my very yeshivish colleagues, his very yeshivish son was getting married, and the wife said, you ain't going to appear on our wedding photos with hands looking like that. You're going to get yourself a manicure, otherwise you ain't coming to the wedding. Okay, Seder. That's apparently a reality in today's world. Maybe that was a bit different when I was 22, but that's the way that the world is today. Therefore, maybe this is... Now, women routinely carry weapons. Now, you're going to say, well, really? Women too? When I lived in Hendon, women didn't routinely carry weapons. No, but they do in Israel. Women carry weapons a lot in Israel, not just in the army, but for protection elsewhere. So maybe you would turn out and say, well, just like men look in mirrors, and just like men have manicures, and clearly that's changed over time, if women wear weapons, then they're unisex. It's no longer a man's thing. Leaving aside the fact, and this is an important point picked up by the Poskim, it could be that the wearing of a weapon was for dress as well. Men walked around with a dress sword on. This was a masculine symbol. We're not talking about that kind of weapon. When an Israeli chayelet is walking around with an M16, she's not doing it as a dress thing. She's doing it because she might need to shoot someone, God forbid. And therefore, it's a very different kind of situation today. And I brought you in source number 12 and 13, the fact that the Rambam very much, and clearly the Shulchan Aruch also, make it very clear that you have to work out what is a tachshit miyuchad la'anashim. What is an adornment which is specifically male? If it's specifically male, then it's prohibited. If it's not specifically male, then maybe there's no problem at all. This, of course, rolls in the question of women wearing pants as well, which is not beged-ish, because women don't wear men's pants. Specifically, they wear women's pants. It is, however, halakhically problematic, but that's because of the issue of tzniut, not because of the issue of beged-ish, which we'll be touching on a little bit. Also, there's another point, which I want to just share with you now on the screen, which is within the halakhas of beged-ish, which, again, is a fascinating eon. We haven't really talked about it ever before. There's another factor, which is if you're wearing women's clothing or men's clothing for practical purposes, forget about minhag, for practical purposes, then that's okay. Look in number 14. Says the Gemara Nadarim, Debitsu the Rebbe Yehuda Nachkat, Nachkat Amra, Va'avda Glima the Hutvi. Rebbe Yehuda's wife went out, took some wool, and made a beautiful thick wool coat. lovely warm coat. Kadnafak Lashuka, when she'd go out to the marketplace, as she'd go out shopping, Michsebeh, she'd wear this beautiful warm wool coat. But Kadnafik Rabbi Yehuda Litziloiba, and when Rabbi Yehuda went to Davin, also out in the cold, Humatsilatsli, he'd also wear the same coat. He'd pick the coat, they used to just keep the coat on a hook in the front, by the front door. She'd pick it up and wear it to shop, to do shopping or whatever. He'd pick it up and wear it to go to shul. And when he wore it, the Kadnech Nisvei Humavarek, he used to make a bracha, Baruch Shetani Me'il, Baruch Hashem, I have such a beautiful coat. How could he wear his wife's coat? The answer is, the Taz makes very clear, in number 15, Derech Idui B'Kishad Asa, that wearing a man's clothing or woman's clothing is only if you're doing it for adornment. Aval Im Oisekei Mitnei Hachama, if you're doing it because it's cold and you need to keep warm, or a warm you need to keep cold, or cold you need to keep warm, or gishamim or to keep off the rain, ain issa. If my wife's raincoat is lying in the corner and it's raining, so I can throw on my wife's raincoat, actually it wouldn't work because she's like a lot smaller than me, but anyway, that's a different question. Sorry, she just heard that. It's not a, whatever. It wouldn't work anyway. But if I needed to do that, then it would. So chenirili poshut, he says this is obvious. This is obvious that wearing a man's or woman's clothing is perfectly permitted if there's another good reason for doing it. Then there's a whole discussion about Purim. Are men allowed to get dressed up as women and women dressed up as men on Purim? So the Ramah brings down here in Hilchos Purim that, look, in theory it's okay because you're not doing it in order to mix with the other gender, you're doing it for fun on Purim. Although other Meforshim, the Bach and others bring down, but it's a really bad idea. Because just think about Purim. Purim is not the Israeli army. Purim, the whole thing is everybody's drinking and everybody's messing around, and therefore a lot of people are unhappy about Purim. I have some very interesting photos from about 25 years ago of some now choshev people as of when they were dressed up as kids on Purim, but I won't go into that now. I'm saving them for the right moment. But anyway, that's beside the point. It could be that there's no real issue here of carrying the gun because it's completely for a practical reason. Leaving aside pikuach nefesh, look in Rav Avadia, number 16, Shaila, Rav Avadia has asked, be yeshuvei ha-safar, there are yeshuvim out in the sticks in Yehuda and Shomron and on the borders of Israel. Okay? There is an obligation on the schools to protect the schools. Alamoiras, on the teachers, they have to carry guns. The women running the kindergartens have to walk around with an M16 on. Are these women allowed to carry weapons? For their own personal protection. Or for the children in the school. And he says very clearly, the first thing he says is, absolutely, it's fine, because they're clearly doing it for the Kuach Nefesh. And he says, look, I've highlighted here, Ein derech, ein lecha davar ha'oimid b'fnei p'kuach nefesh. There's nothing that stands in the way of the Kuach Nefesh. Obviously, if a woman needs a weapon to protect herself, there's nothing to talk about at all. He brings sources there from Sefer Hasidim as well. And clearly, that would apply in the IDF in a very significant way. Not perhaps in every case, but in most cases. And then he brings down also, B'nidon Shelanu, Ein Kavanat Hamorot Menesiyat HaNeshe Kedei Lehitamut LeGevarim. And that's fascinating, because Rav Avadia has brought in this idea of the agenda. Like we saw in the Gemara there, it depends, according to the Tanakhama, whether you're doing it to mix or whether you're just doing it for another reason. And he says, since the women are doing it clearly to protect themselves and their Talmidim, there is no problem at all. But he says at the end, therefore, b'sikum, mutter l'marot l'gananot, shev yishuvei ha-safar, therefore, it's mutter for these women living in these dangerous places, le'hitamen la'achuz b'neshek ve'et shmiratam, they can certainly wear a weapon during shmira, al-bat sefer. Bilvat. However, and we'll see this is very important, she'akpidu ma'od, they have to be terribly careful, I'll call klali ha-tzniut ve'etimun, on the issue of tzniut, which we'll get to right now, karu l'bonot Yisrael ha-ksherot, because they have to make sure that this weaponry doesn't bring them into this less appropriate mixing environment, and we'll talk about that right now. Just one mention before we get into that, there is perhaps a distinction between light weaponry and heavy weaponry. The Rambam, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, the Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz Arab, points out that the Rambam uses the word shiryon. It's from the Gemara as well. Shiryon means body armor, meaning a woman can't dress up in body armor, the kind of thing that men wear during military exercises. If you've ever seen that, what the guys have to wear, the kind of kit the guys have to put on, not just the bulletproof vest, but the whole backpack and the knee pads and everything, is extremely heavy. It's just not something that women can easily do. Obviously, they also have kit they put on. Says Rav Shlomo Israeli, that's what it's talking about. But for a woman to carry a basic light weapon for protection, perhaps it's not talking about that at all. It's a completely different thing. And therefore, a pistol, Rav Moshe Feinstein says there's a difference between a pistol and a rifle. And as I said, in the modern context, an M16 could well be considered a light weapon. And therefore, really, this is all terribly interesting, but actually really quite irrelevant. Because this is not, even though this is brought out as a reason, oh, we can't have religious women in the army because they're not allowed to carry weapons. Actually, halakhically, this is not the central issue. Because there are enough haterim, there are enough contextual reasons that would allow a weapon to be carried by women, and that's not really what it's all about. What's it all about? And the answer is, it's all about tzniut. And we'll see what that means right now. The Rambam, in number 18, let's go back into the sheet. Remember last time, we saw in the sheet, in the shir last time, that the Rambam brings down that a woman goes even from the chuppah for a milchemet mitzvah. The Radvaz says, look at the Radvaz together. The Madhavan Amorim, he writes the Koloshin Rabbeinu, he says, there's a Mishnah like the Rambam. Eladikasha, I don't understand, says the Radvaz, Egypt, 16th century. The Chiderech Hanashim La'atoy Milchama, the women go to fight? How can the Kala leave from her chuppah? Women aren't meant to be in the war. We see this in the Gemara elsewhere. Vaksiv, and he brings this magic verse. Kol kvuda bat melech pnima. You've all heard that expression. Kol kvuda bat melech pnima. What does that mean? And this is, again, if you look at anyone talking about women, religious women in the army, this is the verse that they use again and again and again. So how are we going to translate that? What is that verse? Literally, all the kvuda. What's kvuda? We'll see in a minute. Does it mean glory? Does it mean honor? Does it mean luggage? We'll see soon. Of the bat melech, of the princess, pnima is inside. What does that mean? So let's talk about this principle, because I think this is absolutely central to what we need to do, and central to the issue of women's roles generally in society. We saw the chizkuni. Women are created to raise families. Well, that's not the role of women in society today. So how do we square those two things? Do we just turn around and say the chizkuni is completely irrelevant today? Maybe we do. See now. So I brought you the Tehillim. Kol Kvud Abad Melech Panima is taken from Tehillim Memhei. Tehillim Memhei is about a wedding between a Jewish king and a non-Jewish princess. And it's not 100% clear exactly which princess this is talking about and which king this is talking about. You can see from the context of the verse, I brought the whole thing in translation there, it's praising the queen that she's left her people, the princess, she's left her people to join the Jewish people, etc. Maybe it's Shlomo HaMelech marrying the princess of Tsur. Maybe it's King Ahaz marrying Izebel. It's not clear exactly who this is about. And if you look in the Dat Mikra, it talks a lot about this. But in the middle of this Tehillim is this verse, Kol Kvuda Bat Melech Pnima. Now normally it's translated, all glorious is the king's daughter within the palace. The Dat Mikra says on a pshat level it means her luggage. Her luggage is going inside, and that's what the Malbim says as well in number 22, that we're praising all these beautiful gifts, this gold and silver, all this stuff has been taken, it's all gone inside, and the princess is now going on inside. The Dat Mikra points out that where is the princess going? To the Beit HaNashim. She's going in, and she's staying in, because that's where the princess goes. Remember the Megillat Esther, where Esther goes when she marries Achashverosh into the Beit HaNashim? Once you're in the Beit HaNashim, you ain't coming out that often, only if the king says it's okay. So it's not entirely unreasonable to take this verse and understand it and say the role of the Bat Melech, and here we'll see that Chazal understand every Jewish man to be a Ben Melech, every Jewish woman to be a Bat Melech. The role of the Bat Melech is somehow more internal. And the way it's applied halachically is subtle, but in that vein. I want to bring two halachic examples of how that principle is applied, and then a couple of hashgraphic examples. First of all, in the Gemara in Shavuos, it talks about who is allowed to be an aide. Look with me, number 23, we'll do this quite quickly. V'am b'shnei anashim. Hello? Have I frozen? Apparently I've frozen a little bit. Let's hope that that unfreezes in a second. Can you hear me now? Hopefully you can hear me a little bit now.
Yeah.
Getting a little bit better now?
Now it's good.
Now it's good.
Can you back up a little bit? Can you back up?
Yes, of course, of course, of course. Okay, hopefully people can see me and hear me now. You're just gradually reappearing on my screen as well after a little bit of a glitch. Are you hearing me properly now?
Yes.
I think some of you are, some of you are not. The good news is we actually have a computer engineer coming to the house tomorrow to try and advise us how to improve our internet system. The bad news is it's probably going to cost us a lot of money. Okay, fine, we'll see. We'll see. Let's not prejudge what he has to say. But if we're back with each other again, Baruch Hashem, let's back up just one tiny little bit and talk about the Gemara in Shavuos. The Gemara in Shavuos wants to know who can be an aid. Look with me, number 23, sorry. The Amdu Shnei HaAnoshim, the two men come and stand. Now, who are these two men? The Edim HaKosam Medaber? Are we talking about the Edim? Ata Omer the Edim, or Eina Ela Babali Dinim, or maybe the litigants. Maybe only men are allowed to be litigants in a Jewish court. Maybe he's talking about the litigants, not the aid, not the witnesses. So the Gemara says, really? Amart, do you think so? Who's ever heard of women not coming as litigants? Of course women have court cases. Women come to court to make claims. So it can't be talking about the litigants. The im nash chaloma, alternatively, here's another proof, says the Gemara, neimakan shnei, brings another proof from elsewhere, malahalam be'edim, afkan be'edim. A second proof that this shnei anashim must be talking about the witnesses, not the litigants. So the Gemara says, why did I need a second proof? The first proof was good enough. My im nash chaloma, why do you want to bring me another alternative? I'll tell you why, says the Gemara. Because kitema, you might have said, Isha lav orcha mishum kvoida kol kvoida bas malach panima. Women don't normally come to court. Don't normally come. Because of kol kvoida bas malach panima. So I needed an extra source to prove to you that it's talking about the witnesses, not the litigants. Because you might have thought it is talking about the litigants because women don't normally come. Very interesting. Kol kvoida bas malach panima there is taken to mean, not that women can't come to court, but women don't normally come to court. And therefore, it's not necessarily proscriptive. It's not necessarily defining what women have to do, but more describing what women do. The other case, which is in Gittin, which I'll just explain to you outside, it asks the following question. What if a woman goes to an Ir Miklat, says the Gemara in Gittin? What's an Ir Miklat? If somebody, God forbid, killed somebody by accident, negligently, but by accident, they killed somebody, they have to go to a city of refuge. So the Gemara asks, so when the woman goes to a city of refuge, does her husband have to keep supporting her or not? Can he cut off financial support? So the Gemara says, no, he has to keep supporting her unless she has income, in which case he can say, well, you use your income and I don't need to support you. So the Gemara says, Shkayach, that's true of every woman and every man in every marriage, everywhere. Why is that specially true in the Ir Miklat? To which the Gemara answers, no. You might have thought that women in an Ir Miklat shouldn't be going out into town because of Kol Kvoda Bat Melech Pnima. Why not? Because she's in a strange town, nobody knows her, she's going to have to go tap her business, she's going to have to go see a lot of different people, and therefore you might have thought that the husband had to support her, Kamash Malan. Actually, even there, she can. She can go around the town. Meaning Kol Kvoda Bat Melech Pnima is introducing not a restriction, but a sensitivity on what men and women should be thinking, but this particular woman, the conclusion of the Gemara is that actually she is allowed to go around town. So halachically, Kol Kvoda Bat Melech Pnima doesn't say that women are not allowed to go out. If you look in number 27, look at how the Rambam uses this. Very interesting source in the Rambam. we'll skip 26 for now. Look at 27. How much, says the Rambam, should a man allow his wife to go out of the house? Now, you might think this itself is a ridiculous question, because we'll see Rav Shaul Yisraeli in a minute says that this whole issue does not apply in any way, anything like the same way anymore. But says the Rambam, how often should a husband and a wife, what should their arrangement be? Look at number 27. Says the Rambam, it's in Hilchas Isha. The Fishakol Isha Yesh Lada Tzeit. Women, he says, have to be able to go out. So Leilech Leveit Avia, she has to go to visit her family. Levakro, in order to see them. Leveit Avel, to go to a shiva if she needs to. Leveit Amishta, to go to a wedding. Women have to go out to do mitzvot. Ligimul Chesed, she has to go and help people where she's doing mitzvot. Lereyotea, Ulkrovotea, to her relatives and friends. Kideshiyavo Heimla, because they have to reciprocate. If she can't go out, she can't function. She goes out to do mitzvahs. Look what the Rambam says. She'eina bebeit ha-soar. Because a woman is not locked up in a prison. Marriage is not a prison. Not meant to be a prison. Ashelo teitiv lo tavo. You're telling her she can't go out, she can't come in. Aval genai hu le'isha she'tiyud se tamid. But it's inappropriate, says the Rambam, for women to be always out. For non-mitzvah purposes. And he brings a pasuk in Mishlei about a very inappropriate woman wandering around. The Yesh Labal in Noah Ishto, and here's the controversial line, Yesh Labal in Noah Ishto Mizer, the Loya Nichena Letate Ela Kamo Pam Acha Bechodesh. Or Pam Maim, a husband should let his wife out maybe once or twice a month. He's talking out for non-mitzvah purposes. He already said, for mitzvahs, of course she can go out. I don't know, guys, if shopping is a mitzvah. Going to Mamilla on a regular basis, maybe shopping is a mitzvah in itself. Could be. But the Rambam says if it's not for mitzvahs, once or twice a month. Okay, is that the halacha? I don't think any rav would stand up in any shul today and say a man can only allow his wife out once or twice a month. Kifiyat Torah if she needs to. She'ein yofel eisha eliyeshev bezavit habeisa. A woman really should be sitting in the home. Shekach kosav kol kvuda bat melech pnima. Now, again, if you're going to use this phrase, you have to understand it. If you're going to use this phrase for women in the army, it's important to understand how it applies. The Rambam, by the way, the Rambam lived in Islamic medieval society. It could be, by the way, that letting your wife out once or twice a month was considered to be incredibly lenient in that medieval Islamic society. Let's just get it in context. But the reality is, no one's going to apply that lemaisa today. There's actually a very interesting story in the Gemara, just only in a parentheses. This is just a little bit of a cheeky interlude. But there's a story in the Gemara of someone called Pappas ben Yehuda. Who's Pappas ben Yehuda? Pappas ben Yehuda says that Tosefta just looking where the Tosefta is here. I made a little note of where the Tosefta was. Yeah, it's a Gemara in Shabbos, it's the Sefer as well. Pappas ben Yehuda locked his wife up in the house and refused to let her out because he was a tyrannical, obsessive, controlling husband, says the Sefer. And Mrs. Pappas ben Yehuda managed to escape, as you would expect her to. And not only did she escape, but she went off and had an affair. And says the Sefer, that's what happens when you try and lock your wife up in the house. She's going to rebel, and she's going to... And, of course, where it gets very interesting is the Gemara in Shabbos, which was censored by the church. The Gemara in Shabbos in Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph, which was censored by the church, says, who is Pappas ben Yehuda and his wife? Pappas ben Yehuda and his wife are Joseph and Mary, of the famous Christian story, okay? His wife was Miriam, and he was an obsessive husband, and she escaped from his clutches. She ran off with a Roman called Pandera. She had an illegitimate child, and we all know who that child turned out to be. Now, this is very interesting in and of itself. Of course, it was censored out by the church. I think that the Gemara is making the very clear point that if you try to lock up your wife, you may end up having some consequences which will reverberate for all history in a way that you never imagined before. But nevertheless, the Rambam says, so what's Kvodavat Melech Panima? So, Rav Kook talks about the issue of women voting, women standing for election, he brings that as well. Rav Shaul Yisraeli makes a point which I think is the key point that we need to look at now, which is, it obviously has to be contextual. You can't just throw out Kol Kvuda Bat Melech Pnima as a reason why women can't be in the army unless it makes sense in today's world. Look with me, number 29. Makfoid Melech, Kol Kvud Abad Melech Pnima. What are the boundaries, says Rav Shaul Yisraeli, of Kol Kvud Abad Melech Pnima? Tluyim b'minhagi hamakonos. It has to be relevant to the place and the time that you live. Rak b'makom shedarkan shel nashim shelol atet legamri. In a place where women never went out at all, in the Rambam's medieval society, midatehem. Yesh b'zeh mishum pirtat geder. Pirtat geder. Then you could say it's a breach of tzniut. Ach v'dorotein, but in our generation, says Rav Shaul Yisraeli, of dot v'not Yisrael k'sheirot. From Jewish women work, the misradim, in offices shonim of all different types. The bate cholim, in hospitals, the gani yeladim, in schools, bate sefer, the ein positive peo, the satsis. Nobody has a problem with women. This, of course, is called the, sometimes called the Beit Yaakov paradox, which is, on the one hand, officially called Kvud Abad Melech Pnima, the place of the woman is at the in the family bringing up the children. And on the other hand, since the guys are in Kollel learning, and in many cases very, very, learning very well, the women have to be out in the workplace. How do you square that? How do you square the reality of the women have to be out and have to be in at the same time? I suppose it means if you're a woman, you can do two things, you know, you can balance all that and make it all work. But says Rav Shaul Yisraeli, any statement of Kol Kvud Abad Melech Pnima has to be applied sensitively. Now, that doesn't mean it can be ignored, and I think this is an important point, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about the underlying philosophical battle here, because I think this is very important. When you're talking about women in the Israeli army, I think the halachic, ultimately the halachic angles are a little bit of a red herring. When you talk about the women carrying a weapon, I think we've seen, we can deal with that halachically. The real issue is, how do you apply this issue of a woman's role in Kol Kvud Abad Melech Pnima? You can't just bring out a decontextualized source from the Rambam and say women can't leave the house. That doesn't make any sense. But you can't ignore it either. You can't just say, tznius is something that, you know, other groups of people focus on. No, this is a central role of a Jewish man, especially a Jewish woman, the Bat Melech. How do you apply that in a way which makes sense but is relevant in society? And I think, you know, tzniut generally is part of this difficult question. People tend to either be obsessed about tzniut in the frum society, or very anti talking about it and very resistant. And both of those extremes are clearly inappropriate, because to be obsessed about it is extremely unhealthy. But on the other hand, to see it as some kind of Haredi issue is also completely wrong, because it is a central Jewish concept. And we did actually talk about this once many years ago, and I don't have time to go into it now, but I did bring the on the sheet in sources 31 through 34, 35, the issue of the source in the Torah for tzniut. Where does it say in the Torah that there is a mitzvah of tzniut? And by the way, some of those who count the 613 mitzvahs, like the smack, for example, clearly counts this, the Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, as one of the 613 mitzvahs. And the answer is, maybe I will just show you here on the sheet, because I think it is very important for our purposes. Let's look together at this issue. Source number 30, Kitei Machane, okay, Aloi Vecha, when you go out to fight against your enemies, okay, the Nishmata Mikol Davara, you must be very careful not to get into difficult things. Why? Look at the Rambam. We know what it's like in war. They eat anything. People are starving, the soldiers, they'll kill anything and eat it. They steal and they raid and they pillage. And they rob people. And they're not embarrassed. Soldiers behave extremely badly. The amount of rape and sexual violence, all these terrible things. By the way, I put in the footnotes, perhaps the height of absurdity is a report that came out of Hebrew University about 15 years ago that says that given the lack of incidents of sexual violence of Israeli soldiers in IDF against Arab women, it must be evidence of their deep racism that all soldiers behave badly, and only the IDF do not do that. That's because they're deeply anti-racist, anti-Arab racist, and anti-Palestinian. I brought you a link to the research paper. You can read it and laugh or cry, depending on which whichever, you know, takes you there. But the Ramban basically says, Vayashav, Bnei Adam, even the straightest of people, the Tivo in their nature, Yitlabesh Ba'achsuri Yod, becomes a different person in the war. I remember when I was a kid, we had to read, for my German A-level, we had to read All Quiet on the Western Front, which is a fascinating book. About soldiers during the First World War, and many of you may have read it, and it talks about the dehumanization of soldiers and how they become ultimately completely different to how they would have ever behaved before. Says the Ramban, that's not an environment in which you want people to just be in an indiscriminate way. And in fact, the mitzvah of tzniut comes from there. Look at number 32. Yat yelecha mechutz lamachane. You have to have a designated place outside your camp. The yatzata shamachutz, and you have to go out there. The yatet tielecha, and you have to have a peg, a little shovel, ala zanecha, on your kit. V'ayah b'shiftecha chutz, when you need to use the bathroom, says the Torah. V'chapar taba, dig a little hole outside the camp. V'shafte v'kesita etzeitecha, do what you need to do and cover it up. Behave like a mensch, even in extremis. Ki Hashem lokecha mitalech b'kerev machanecha. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in your machane, la'atilcha, la'tet oivecha lefanecha. He is the one that's saving you. Vaya machanecha kodesh. These key words, haya machanecha kodesh. Your encampment, your military camp has to be kodesh. V'lo yerbecha ervat davar. This word erva, obviously very important. Misconduct, sexual misconduct, behaving in an undignified way, even in the camp. This is the root of the mitzvah of tzniut. I'm not getting into how it all applies in society, but when you look, where does it say in the Torah there's a mitzvah to be tzanuah? The answer is, it's a mitzvah of Hayah Machanecha Kodesh. That especially in war, that is the place where Chazal learn out the mitzvah of Tzniut and how it applies. However, Tzniut itself is very minhag oriented, and I'm not getting into that now, how it applies in a practical way. What does all this mean, Lemaisa? Let's talk about some more broad issues. Actually, there's a deep philosophical battle going on. The halachic issues of women being in the army are not really that difficult. I mean, they're hard. It's tough. The army is meant to be tough. But the halachic issues, the army is very, very careful with its kashrut. It's very careful with allowing people to keep Shabbat. Obviously, there are limitations. It's generally speaking very careful in terms of giving people time to daven and allowing women to wear skirts. There's an interesting, leaving aside the bigger issue of tzniut, should an Israeli soldier, chayelet, should she wear a skirt or pants? So if she's on base and she's crawling around and training, etc., and she's wearing what they call bets, so then obviously pants are necessary, required, and halakhically actually probably more appropriate, because you can't crawl around the ground and jump over walls wearing a skirt, okay? However, if she's wearing alas, if she's out in the street in wearing her dress uniform, is there any justification for a religious woman to be wearing pants then? I actually had a student of mine who became a soldier. She went to Garin Sabar in Kibbutz Lavi, a frum girl, and she said, can I wear pants or should I wear a skirt? And I said, don't ask me, ask the Rav of the Kibbutz. He is the Rav Yehuda Gilad, who is the Rav of the Kibbutz there, is the Rav of the Kibbutz. And he told her, no, for bets, obviously when you're crawling around on the floor, you have to wear pants. But for Alice, if you normally wear a skirt, you have to wear a skirt. And therefore, the army facilitates that for those who want it. The real issue is not. The real issue is that the army, being in the army, and therefore the choices that gives young people afterwards in terms of going to university, I've done quite a lot of research, spoken to quite a lot of family members and other people who are soldiers, young soldiers. There's a battle of philosophies going on here. Young people today have grown up in a world which is very egalitarian, very feminist-oriented, and very postmodern in a way that we don't always realize. What's postmodern? In the sense that there's no objective truth. There's no objective clear right and wrong. It's your truth and my truth, and as long as we don't harm other people, then everything's okay. That is, there are elements in which Torah thought can connect with those ideas, yes. But it's fundamentally not a Torah perspective on the world, egalitarianism or postmodernism, etc. And I put more on the sheet about that. One of the real challenge that people have, and if you read Rabbi Aviner, he's very clear on this, the real challenge of young religious women going to the army is it puts them in an incredibly secular environment, which is very mixed, which is very philosophically distracting from religious growth. And therefore, very often for these girls, anyway within the Dati community, there is a major phenomenon of kids becoming much less religiously connected. There's a lot of studies on this, and there's a lot of, and there are other massive problems and challenges in the Haredi sector as well. Obviously, different challenges. But there's a lot of people who drift into more of a light kind of religious world or a datlash world. There's a lot to be said about that. The army clearly is a place which takes over the mind of an individual. It has to. And therefore, the real concern is people who, the real concern is people who are putting themselves in this environment, which is likely to affect their choices for university, for career, delaying marriage, etc. If you look below the surface, that's the real issue. Somebody asked the question, is it different for men? And the answer is, it's also challenging for men. But with men, there is more of a system of heads there. You go in with your guys, you come out with your guys, and it's still very challenging. And actually, in many senses, for men, there is also a major problem of attrition after the army, of guys who went in very strong, come out much less strong. And we need to really work out, you know, what, how that works and what we can do about that. We can't avoid the men going to the army, and it's a mitzvah. But the question with the women is really framed in that way. Let me just finish with Rav Meidan. Rav Yaakov Meidan, I brought you some important sources that you need to, you know, check out if you're interested in this issue. Rav Meidan says the follows, he's the head of one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva Teretz Tzion, and he's very, very into the army. He's obviously a great Zionist, very strongly focused on sending the guys into the army and helping them succeed. Number 38. He wrote, "We love the army," and I brought you a source for his original words as well. You can look that up. "And value it tremendously. We want to integrate as equals in all units. However, the IDF, led by the Chief of Staff's advisor on gender issues, is trying to re-educate us and force us into a culture we are not accustomed to. And this we cannot accept," he said. "I believe in the army. I served in the army, including in the reserves, until the age of 59. Rav Meidan was still running with the troops when my son was in the army. All my children served in the IDF, all my boys in elite units. I believe in the army. And I tell you that in the past 2 years, this was a couple of years ago already, something terrible has occurred which is taking us backwards. We sat for many months and came up with a resolution called proper integration. This was our final position. Now everything has been undone and we have mixed service." He says there's agendas going on to try and mix people in the army. "The danger is also for boys, like you pointed out, but primarily for girls. I'm not saying they shouldn't enlist, but we must all fight vocally against this." And that's one of the reasons why, really across the board, the religious Zionist leadership is very nervous about women in the army. Because there's a battle of philosophies going on. A little bit like in the 1950s, when they were originally fighting this, there's a different battle of philosophies about religious coercion. That's not the battle we're fighting today. The battle we're fighting today is a battle against postmodernism, relativism, secularism, egalitarianism, and the army inculcates people with those ideas and launches them into an area. Now, what's the answer? The answer is not, like, disband the army, obviously. The answer is not to say to all people, you know, you can't join the army, although Rav Aviner got himself into some hot water when he said to a boy that if you cannot enlist, and he is a big Zionist, Rav Aviner, as you know, one of the leaders of religious Zionism, he said to one of his students, if you cannot be in an environment in the army which is religiously positive, don't join the army at all, which was, you know, a lot of people criticized him for that, etc. But I brought you more on that on the sheet. There's a side issue whether women are allowed to be officers in the army, and I brought you some sources on that too. That may be actually part of the solution, not just part of the problem. There's an issue in halacha. Are women allowed to take leadership roles in society? I'm not getting into all of that now. There are different views on that. But having women officers may actually solve or resolve some of the issues of having women in the army that need female leadership as well. But that's something you can look at on your own. So at the end of the day, I think this is a really critical microcosm of something which is happening in religious society as a whole. We need to work out, and I'll leave you with this thought, and I have no quick answers on this. My son's actually writing a paper on this and looking into this. We need to work out what is causing many of our young people to be, on the one hand, highly idealistic, very impressive, very focused, the kind of children and grandchildren that we're extremely proud of, and yet religiously drifting into a place of very light connection with halacha, if connection at all, in many areas. And we need to try and work out whether the army can be part of the solution here or is always going to be part of the problem. The halachic issues we can work around. And as I try to show you, hopefully, you know, there are some solutions there. But this is something which will run and run, and therefore I have no way of solving it today. I just wanted to raise it so you can think about it. Some of you may disagree with what I've said, which is fine too. feel free to write to me and argue with me. And again, I really recommend that you look at the sheet and read it and follow the links. The links on the document will be live on your screen. You can do a lot of reading around this. Maybe we can pick this up again. I did think, just to finish off for a second, about making a third part, but I decided not to do that. I decided two parts is enough in the army. Next week, what I want to get to is a completely different issue, which is very Lamaita, which is Minyanim and Tefillah in weird places, which is what we're dealing with the situation we're in right now. What about porch Minyanim, Mirpeset Minyanim, Zoom Minyanim, Zoom Kaddish, all of this kind of stuff? That's going to be our topic for next week, which is going to take us away from the army. But for now, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much again for joining. It's been a wonderful share. I'm sorry about the glitch. We only had one, Baruch Hashem. Next week we will hopefully get together. We should be well. As I said before, that the learning we did should be an aliyah for the neshama of Professor Steiner, who we very much miss. But we welcome Mrs. Steiner, Yivadu Ben Chaim L'Chaim, and hope she'll join us for many, many more shiurim to come. Thank you all, and we'll see you very soon.
Thank you very much.